Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
You know, I didn't plant a lot of tomatoes this year. I just feel like they're really abundant here, and I'm able to get what I need from farmers at the farmers market.
Kate Young on the show today talking about tomatoes and canning and her love of radio. Daniel Orr makes a big vat of ratatouille for an old friend. From Harvest Public Media today, grocery store customers are starting to dine more at the growing number of in-house, full-service supermarket restaurants. And it's a big day in the Earth Eats office. We'll share the news at the very end of the show. Gotta check in with Mark Chilla.
First up, Annie, a story about pesticides. Applying large amounts of pesticides to farm fields can have negative effects on babies born to mothers living nearby. That's according to a new data-crunching study that looked at the farm-heavy San Joaquin Valley in California. Researchers matched birth records to pesticide application rates for the mother's address. Most babies were fine, but the 1% exposed to the greatest amounts of pesticides showed lower birth weights and more abnormalities. Here's study author Ashley Larson of the University of California, Santa Barbara.
We see these important effects, but just for a small subset of the population living in this agriculturally dominated region. We're working on trying to understand what's behind these hot spots of pesticide use and when they occur.
The study could not identify individual pesticides, but farmers in both California and the Midwest apply some of the same ones. A new study found that staple crops, like corn and wheat, which provide a large proportion of the world's calories and U.S. farmers' output, will likely see negative impacts from rising global temperatures. An international group of researchers compiled dozens of studies and found that every time global temperatures go up 1 degree Celsius, crop yields fall. On average, the study found a drop of 3% for soybeans, 6% for wheat, and 7% for corn. Researchers used projections to calculate global average temperatures and yields. In some cases, yields went up. Writ large, however, the study found overall declines. Yields for corn and soybeans would decline more in the U.S. than in other parts of the world. The study, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, suggests any gains American farmers earn by adopting better farming technology will first have to make up for what's lost to a warmer world. And in the run-up to last year's Brexit referendum, many British farmers complained that too much regulation and bureaucratic waste was stifling agriculture. But now, growing uncertainty about high tariffs and cheap imports has challenged farmers' optimism. The EU provided $3.8 billion a year in subsidies for British farmers, in some cases accounting for 80% of their incomes. The subsidy burden will shift to the British government when the UK's departure is complete, but it's unclear how much of that will be covered. Also looming ahead is a trade deal with the United States, where meat is produced far more cheaply due in part to practices banned in the UK, including the use of hormones and antibiotics to boost growth. Likewise, American poultry is produced more cheaply because the meat is washed in chlorine to get rid of bacteria, a practice banned across the pond because it allows birds to be raised in less sanitary conditions. A study from the Agri-Food Biosciences Institute indicates sheep farmers could lose up to 38% of their value if the UK does not hammer out a free trade deal with the EU. Overall, the country's National Farmers Union has welcomed Brexit and hopes it will lead to long-term self-sufficiency. For now, the NFU has joined a group of trade organizations calling for the UK to stay within the EU's tariff zone during a transition period to prevent a sudden burden on farmers. Thanks to Chad Bouchard and the Harvest Public Media team for our stories this week.
You know the drill. At Earth Eats on Twitter and eartheats.org for the website. Mark, Chilla, it's been great.
It's been real, Annie Corrigan.
Imagine going to the grocery store for dinner, not to pick up a rotisserie chicken to take home, but to actually eat at the store. Many supermarkets are adding sit-down restaurants, and it's shaking up the food service landscape. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted reports from Columbia, Missouri.
At the Hy-Vee grocery store in Columbia, just past the produce aisle, in between the sushi and deli counters, are glass doors marked with the words Market Grill. Inside, it's happy hour. There's music playing and TVs showing sports. 30-year-old Rob Hunt grabs a booth with his friend and opens the menu featuring half-off appetizers.
We've been coming almost every Wednesday this summer for our after-work beer.
All of the ingredients for the menu come from the store. They're cooked in the kitchen and served here. Hunt says the variety of food, the local craft beer on tap, and ultimately the price are a big draw.
You can't get $2 pints of beer anywhere else. And that's honestly like the biggest thing. We tried a couple other places this summer and they were fun, but like it's just cheaper here.
We just thought it was the next natural step to add restaurants that have, you know, a full service bar.
Jeremy Gosh is an executive vice president with Hy-Vee.
You know, a seating area apart from the store, different ambiance, different lighting, different atmosphere, different sound, different music, full service.
The trend of adding supermarket restaurants, sometimes called grocerants, falls in line with the uptick in prepared store meals, which drove $10 billion in sales last year, according to research firm the NPD Group. Jeremy Gosh says people are looking for more options in prepared foods, and the traditional center of the store, with cans of beans and boxes of cereal, has had to make room.
I think as you look long term and we continue to roll out into existing stores, you know, some food service updates and expansion, especially on meals to go for consumption at home, I think you'll see a little bit of that compression.
A large part of this shift is thanks to millennials, who are more likely to dine out than other generations. Millennials surveyed by financial services firm Morgan Stanley were 10% more likely to have eaten out in the past week. Today, grocerants are hiring Culinary Institute of America graduates as chefs and featuring seasonal menus, just like downtown restaurants.
From a food safety standpoint, they're very similar.
Adam Inman is with the Kansas Department of Agriculture's Food Safety Program. He says state inspectors have expanded their evaluation of grocery stores since the upswing in grocerants. Officials take food temperatures and inspect storage and cleanliness, all to prevent foodborne illnesses like E. coli, Salmonella, and Listeria.
It's added some complexity and some length. It just takes longer to look at a more complex operation like a full-service grocery store that also does food service.
Food industry analyst Phil Lempert says that when it comes to food safety, supermarkets have a lot of consumer trust, which bodes well for grocerants and appeals to millennials who have typically patronized fast casual joints, places that have had recent food safety struggles.
It's really been a lot of the restaurants like Chipotle that doesn't have, you know, the same kind of controls that supermarkets do across that whole supply chain.
Indeed, millennials are also turning away from slumping restaurant chains like Chili's or Applebee's, which plans to close up to 60 locations this year, in favor of what they deem fresher and a better value. That's forcing some chains to look toward grocery stores as potential partners. Think of Starbucks and Caribou Coffee kiosks in grocery stores. Except in this case, Wolfgang Puck wants his cafe to become the in-house restaurant.
Now these restaurateurs want their space in the supermarket as well because they know that it's more convenient for people, it's more of a one-stop shop, and it's hurting their traditional restaurants.
Phil Lempert says the next step may be to add home meal delivery options. Food marketers are looking at the Amazon purchase of Whole Foods and seeing the addition of more grocerants and also home deliveries of groceries and dinner together. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Ratatouille is best made in bulk and shared with friends. That's how Daniel Orr sees it. We start this story by setting up the friendship that's at the center of it. Daniel is Southern Indiana born and raised. He's worked in restaurants in France, the Caribbean, and New York City over the years. He came back home in 2008 to be closer to his family. That's when he met Yael Cassander, a producer at WFIU Bloomington. She was born and raised in Virginia, also spent some time in France, then moved to Indiana, and all along the way was a fan of Daniel's cookbooks. When they met, they were quick friends.
And she was actually the first one that interviewed me way back when I first opened the restaurant. And
whatever she asks for, she gets. And she asked for the ratatouille recipe.
Yael cooks ratatouille at home a lot, so she wanted tips from the chef for upping her game.
I always suggest, I mean, there's no reason to make a cup of ratatouille. You know, you want to make a gallon of ratatouille. It's great on pasta, it's great in omelets, it's great in scrambled eggs, and it's great cold as a salad on its own. So I'm going to get started. I generally cook this on the stove, but since we're in a busy restaurant, I'm going to do it in our pizza oven. I'm going to add the olive oil to a hot pan. Okay, and then I'm going to start adding my veggies. So I'm putting my garlic in first. Just going to spread that over the whole pan. Okay, and then the next ingredient is generally your onions. I'm just going to stir that around and put that back in the oven and let those onions cook until they're soft. All right, we're going to add the remaining ingredients, which are eggplant, zucchini, or you could use yellow summer squash, and we've got red, green, yellow, and orange peppers. So it's gonna have lots of nice color to it. And the other important ingredients are tomatoes. And I'm also going to throw some scallions, and I've got some golden carrots. So again, this is another recipe that you can use up all your garden produce or all of your homeless vegetables in the bottom of your refrigerator.
Stir those in, pop it in the oven, and turn the flame up, and cook that for 15 to 20 minutes, stirring every few minutes.
So we've let these cook down quite a bit. You can see that it's about half the volume. I also added a bouquet garni, which is this herb bundle that's tied together with some butcher's twine, and then I tie it to the handle of the baking pan so I can find it very easily. And so that's rosemary and thyme. You could put bay leaf, you can put other fresh herbs like marjoram or oregano in there. And we're just gonna kind of bury it in there, and that's going to perfume the ratatouille. And then a couple non-traditional items that I added are some orange juice and some orange zest. All right, and that's going to add a touch of sweetness to it. The zest is going to give it that beautiful floral flavor. Salt and pepper, and that is about it. So I'm just going to pop this back in the back of the oven for about another 5 or 10 minutes. We want it to kind of brown a little bit on top, get nice and thick. And you can see that tomato paste that I added, which I added about for this amount, about a cup, that really kind of brought everything together and made that nice thick sauce on it. So again, back into the oven for another 10 minutes, and then we'll see them on the other side. All right, so we've got that ratatouille out of the oven. You can kind of see it's a wonderful vegetable stew, glistening. Okay, we're going to finish this with a few fresh herbs. Really roughly chopped basil. Italian parsley. If you serve this cold, I also like to add some fresh mint, you know, so cool it down, fold in some fresh mint. It really gives it kind of an exotic flavor. So, you know, this is a nice base recipe. Make it your own.
And with that, he scooped a portion of the fresh from the oven ratatouille into a quart container and asked me to deliver it to his old friend Yael. So I hopped in my car and drove across town, balancing this tub of ratatouille in the cup holder.
Special delivery!
Hey, hi! This is so nice. Wow, so what have we got here?
So it's some eggplant, tomatoes, zucchini.
Gosh, and it's still warm. This looks beautiful. I am a ratatouille junkie, and I make it every week. So I'll be curious to see what Chef has produced here. The aroma is wonderful. I just wish I had a glass of red wine right now.
Is that an eggplant?
Mm-hmm. And it's so tender. I have to say, Chef, that I think you and I are French in our souls. And I remember very fondly going to the all-night bistro in Georgetown as a teenager called Au Pied de Cochon. I would steal away there at age 16 in the middle of the night. My parents had no idea where I was. We'd go, you could order ratatouille, omelets, and French fries. And we felt absolutely so sophisticated. And the only thing that would have made that experience more complete would have been if you had been there with me, but I think you were in spirit. Your version, though, is better.
Just gonna eat it straight out of the container.
How much can I have?
Oh, it's all for you. A special, special thanks to Yael Cassander for her little cameo in today's show. And she thanks Daniel Orr for the surprise ratatouille. If you didn't catch all the ingredients, no problem. It's posted at eartheats.org. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses. Located on the Beeline Trail, more information at personalfinancialservices.net. Need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview, needmoreroasters.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. I'm Annie. You're with Earth Eats. President Donald Trump continues to fill political appointments, and his nomination for the top science job at the Department of Agriculture is raising unique concerns. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports on the nominee for Undersecretary of Agriculture for Research, Education, and Economics.
President Trump has chosen Sam Clovis for the post, also called the Chief Scientist at USDA. Clovis served as a fighter pilot in the Air Force, has a doctorate in public administration, and taught economics at Morningside College in Sioux City, Iowa. That's also where he gained a following as a conservative talk show host. Des Moines Register political columnist Kathy Obradovich says the radio show gave Clovis name recognition, but the Republican Senate primary in 2014 is where his personality grabbed wider attention.
Sam Clovis was very articulate on the stump. He did a really good job of boiling down complex issues so that people could understand them. And frankly, he was funny.
Still, he lost, and he went on to lose the statewide race for treasurer that year, too. But then a curious thing happened.
He joked that he's the only guy he knows who has lost two elections in the period of 4 months and had his political stock rise.
Clovis ran the Trump campaign in Iowa, became an advisor on agriculture, and landed at USDA as part of the White House transition team. Political observers see his nomination to undersecretary as direct payback for his loyalty to Trump. But here's the thing. He's not a scientist. The U.S. code establishing the position says the person should be selected from, quote, among distinguished scientists with specialized training or significant experience in agricultural research, education, and economics.
Sam Clovis, regardless of all of his other merits, does not fulfill the basic requirements that are stipulated.
That's Ricardo Salvador, director of the Food and Environment Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Salvador recognizes that the description is broad and accepts the argument that Clovis could fit under the economics category. But Salvador says Clovis has not distinguished himself in a relevant field. What's more,
Mr. Clovis has actually expressed open skepticism about fundamental scientific issues that have a direct bearing on the quality of decisions that he might be called upon to make, actually would be called upon to make.
Salvador is referring to climate change. During the 2014 Senate campaign, Clovis was asked whether he believed the science on climate change.
I am extremely skeptical. I've looked at the science, and I have enough of a science background to know when I'm being boofed, and I think a lot of what we see is junk science.
Salvador says such a person should not be leading a $3 billion USDA agency, the one that funds a network of regional climate hubs, among many other programs.
Climate change is a very real phenomenon that farmers have to deal with.
Democratic Senator Michael Bennett from Colorado serves on the Agriculture Committee. He recently told a reporter he didn't know what influence Clovis would have on climate research. But Bennett himself is committed to USDA's research funding.
We are fighting extremely hard to preserve the research dollars in our Department of Agriculture budget.
USDA is a sprawling department, and Clovis would lead an agency filled with career civil servants and seasoned scientists from many disciplines. Register columnist Kathy Obradovich says Clovis does have relevant leadership experience. He showed during his Senate campaign his ability to school himself on important issues, and she's confident he's an independent thinker, not an ideologue.
He's not just completely going to be a political hack. I do think that he will listen to people, you know, who have the scientific knowledge.
To her point, in the same 2014 interview in which he calls himself a climate science skeptic, Clovis closes with this remark.
I could probably be convinced, but right now I'm not.
Clovis's nomination drew a support letter from 24 farm and commodity groups. In contrast, another of Trump's USDA picks got the endorsement of more than 100 such groups. A date for Clovis's Senate confirmation hearing has not yet been made public. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Find more stories like this at harvestpublicmedia.org. So, as I said, this is a big day at Earth Eats. After, almost 8 years of podcasts, and web posts and tweets and even a cookbook, I'm out of here. I'm off to explore Canada and have some new life adventures. As I've been thinking back on all the great stuff we've done on Earth Eats, I'm amazed at how much I've learned personally about eating and growing food and preserving food, which is key for gardeners right now.
Okay, so we've got one of them started, and when these boil, we'll set their timers as well.
That's Kate Young, teaching a canning workshop at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard. I've interviewed her several times, and, you know, I've often gone back to those articles on our website right before I start canning food to make sure I'm doing what Kate recommends. Like, you know, when it's safe to use a hot water canning method.
High-acid foods are fruits, jams, tomatoes, add lemon juice. Acidified foods, use a canning recipe. And that can be pickles, ketchup, chutney, salsa. And then for all your other foods, you're going to want to do pressure canning. So that's going to be low acid foods, and that's going to be vegetables that aren't pickled. And then pasta sauce, meat, soup, or stock. Like once you start adding other vegetables to it besides tomatoes, it's no longer safe for boiling water bath canning, unless it's an acidified food using a canning recipe. Is that...
Hey, Kate.
Hello, Annie.
So you did that canning workshop, what was it, last week? What did you teach folks?
Well, we did some canning of local tomatoes. Nothing better than an Indiana tomato, and we homegrown, and these were fresh from our local farmers and gardeners.
And so people were able to take some canned tomatoes home with them?
Yes, everyone took home a pint of canned tomatoes.
Wow. Well, so I wonder, how's your garden? Are you getting a lot of tomatoes this season?
You know, I didn't plant a lot of tomatoes this year. I just feel like they're really abundant here, and I'm able to get what I need from farmers at the farmers market. So I usually just plant a couple of plants, just some of my favorite heirloom slicers, and then... I always like to have a few cherry tomato plants because those are great for just snacking and putting in salads and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Okay, well, what's your favorite heirloom slicer?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. I really like the Brandywine. I think that's probably my favorite.
So tomatoes are all over the place in Indiana right now, but where I am in Newfoundland, tomatoes, they haven't come on at all yet.
Wow. So what do you know about the growing season up there?
Well, I'm still learning, but, you know, basically everything's a month or two late at the farmer's market right now. We got a lot of greens and a lot of root veggies. But the coolest thing here is all the wild berries, you know, blueberries and raspberries, and all these wacky berries that I'd never even heard of.
Oh, wow. So are those coming on now, or is that still a ways away?
Those are now. It's a big thing right now to go out and go blueberry picking, and also chanterelles.
Oh, that's great. I mean, our chanterelle season has ended, but not long ago. Like, people were still getting them a couple weeks ago. So what else have you discovered about local food in Newfoundland?
Well, the big thing is figuring out what local meat is.
Uh-huh.
And then what local means in Newfoundland. So if you look on a map, I live at the easternmost point of North America.
Right. I noticed that. I was looking at a map, and it just seemed like you were in the most easterly place possible on land in North America.
Yeah, and we don't have a whole lot of pasture land. It's, you know, they call it the Rock.
Oh.
But luckily, you know, we're surrounded by water, so the seafood is amazing.
That's wonderful. So that's your fresh local food. That's your fresh local protein,
yeah.
Sounds like.
Yeah.
But there are farmers. There are people growing food. You said there's farmers markets.
Yeah, and that's what I need to learn a little bit more. There's a St. John's farmers market every week, and then there's also this independent farm stand, basically, that's open every day that sells a lot of beautiful stuff. Kohlrabi as big as your head.
Wow. So do you think there will be tomatoes?
They say so. They've promised me tomatoes. I guess we'll see. So all this to say that you're going to be the new producer of Earth Eats. It's your show now.
That's right.
Why did you want to do radio, by the way? We know your connection to food. You were at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard as the nutrition education coordinator for several years. So why radio?
Well, I have been a public radio listener and huge fan for going on 30 years now. And I am a huge fan of Earth Eats. And, you know, being so connected to food, food has really been my passion for the past 10 years or so. And I just really am excited to have this opportunity to take the reins. I do know that all of the Earth Eats listeners, myself included, will sure miss hearing your voice.
Oh, that's sweet. I love you guys.
Well, send us a postcard or post a photo of a favorite meal now and then, will ya?
Yeah, you better believe it.
All right. Thank you, Annie.
Thanks, Kate. Bye.
Bye. The first thing on my to-do list as your new host is to thank our production supporters. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses. Located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview. NeedMoreRoasters.com. I'm your new host, Kate Young. See you next week.